sure, Arrogate, it was quite a gracious introduction. I can only blow it after that intro. So listen, it really is a privilege and a pleasure to be here with you. Alec gave me the brief of, can I talk about the prospects of South Africa and make a case for it in a way? That's how I interpreted the brief. I have literally 8 slides I want to show you, right? So I'll stay with the first slide, but I wanted to show you some data to make my case. And essentially what I want to do is I want to make the case for a certain kind of leadership. We're in a complex world at the moment. It is really interesting. I was in Davos literally, I don't know, Alec, 6 weeks ago. Six weeks ago, you were there. It's the GNU was in place. Structural load shedding had come down. And the impression about the country was fundamentally different. Positive, shedding to global asset managers. For the first time I've ever seen people talk about the potential seems really high, et cetera, et cetera. A few weeks later, the expropriation law comes in, the U.S. administration overlay, and we're now back in a cycle of real concern, and it's complex. It is complex. But I guess my case, and I want to make this, if I get anything across to you, is I want to make a case for leadership, government, business, civil society, that holds the middle. We mustn't let the extremes come out. It's problematic. When one extreme comes out, the other side comes up. I'm really happy to hear the previous speaker, a really colorful and wonderful minister, just make the point about the importance of the GNU. But my case for holding the middle is based on 3 hypotheses, 3 strategies that I really hold dear, and I want to kind of use some data to make the point to you. The first issue is the issue of loss aversion, right? The issue of understanding how big our country is, how relevant it is, what scale it is. It's a critical issue. We know from behavioral economics, one of the great theories is the idea of loss aversion, that people are motivated more by potential loss than by potential gain, right? If you think there's nothing here, it's a tiny economy, it's broken, there's nothing to gain from it, that gets people into a situation where they don't see much motivation. On the other hand, if people see a country of considerable potential with a huge amount of assets and there's a lot to lose, you get a very, very different emotion. And we know that from behavioral science. So the first issue for me, the first kind of axiom is we need leadership that holds the middle and gives people a sense of what we have here that we need to treasure and protect against. So the first slide, if I can go to it, is something that I kind of find, I've used these statistics many, many times. They surprise many people. They irritate a lot of people, right? And hopefully they delight some people. If you can just change to that first slide. It really shows you a kind of an arcane bunch of statistics. I can't see the slide, if you can. You're winning there. Oh, there we go. A few bits of statistics that just give you a sense of relevance and scale. Now, no naivety here. Firstly, just you may not know this, but Gauteng's economy is nearly the size of the Ukraine. Now, if you know that, people often don't think about that. This is pre the war, and I say it sensitively. It's a country under considerable war stress, but it's in the news of relevance, of mineral wealth, of the pivot to a third world war, yet Gauteng itself is bigger or close to the size of the Ukraine. It's intriguing. I flew Joburg to Cape Town yesterday. It's, I think, the 10th busiest air route in the world. It really is hard to believe. Our banks, I shouldn't be punting Standard Bank, but I am a fan of all our banks. They're brilliant. Standard Bank's balance sheet is bigger than all of Nigeria's banks put together. And then they have these deep capital markets. It's quite interesting that over 80% of the entire continent's long-term assets are sitting in South Africa. It's a really interesting bunch of statistics. I don't say it naively. I hope you get it. But I want to make the point of the scale of what we've got to lose and the scale of what we've got to protect. And on the positive side, the scale of what we need to build. The second point I want to make from our data, one of the big issues that really upsets people and rightly so is crime. And I'm a victim of crime. I'm sure many people are here as well. But let me just show you some data from our data. We cover millions of people across the country in our property and casualty business, our motor insurance business. We watch claims very carefully. Just have a look at the trends that we've seen or are seeing. If you can go to the next slide. It's really interesting. This is kind of, it's showing you motor theft, household theft in two lines. And what you can see from 20, I can't see it without getting closer, but 2013 to 2025, a dramatic decrease in levels of theft. So both hijacking, motor theft. And whether you cut the data by kind of size of the house, small houses, large houses, expensive cars, the data is directionally the same. If you look at different provinces, the data is the same. It's downsloping. I don't know why that has happened. Is it private security? It doesn't matter. The employed sector is experiencing dramatically less crime. It talks to the tragedy of the unemployed, where if you accept that their crime rates have not dropped, it means they're going up elsewhere. But in the employed sector, we're seeing a dramatic drop in crime. So when I put these statistics up, someone said to me, yes, but what about violent crime and murders? Well, I took out for this conference, I had our guys do an analysis on the right-hand side of the percentage of deaths caused by trauma and murder. You can see on the extreme right-hand side, a kind of volatile came down during COVID, and you can see it slightly, it went up again below before, now it's coming down. So even if you look at trauma deaths, they are lower than they were. So I'm putting to you just some data points to understand kind of what is the base that we are dealing with. And then the third slide, if I can go to that, is to talk about risk. This is maybe a bit more ephemeral, but I wanted to put the point across to you on this issue. South Africa is seen globally as a very risky environment. I'm out there. I talk to asset managers, investors, stakeholders. It's hard to often get investment. They're concerned about risk. But what is risk? Risk is volatility, standard deviation, right? If you look at our GDP, one of the biggest issues, and that's my basic appeal, we need economic growth. We are not growing. That's the core of the problem. But it's interesting, we're not shrinking either. It's kind of bizarre that during load shedding, during we had no power, the economy did not contract. I'm not sure why. You'd think that it's an obvious thing. Most any checking of economies looks at power drawing, etc. The economy did not contract. So if you look at, I know this is maybe technical or maybe actuarial, but you look at the standard deviation, the variance, the volatility of our GDP growth rate, it doesn't grow, but it doesn't shrink. It's amongst the most stodgy in the world. So variance is low means risk is low. We're not growing, but we're not risky. If you look on the right-hand side, our currency is much more risky. Currency is narrative. Currency is sentiment. It's like the share price of the country. The currency is volatile, but the GDP isn't. So sentiment is worse than reality. And that tends to be one of our biggest issues, and that is always my concern. Narrative is worse than reality, and that's really, really holding us down. So the point I want to make is if you want to lead or you want to motivate people about how we can grow, what the potential is, they have to understand what they've got to lose. And there's a lot to lose. This is a big economy with a lot of sophistication, a lot of potential. And while those statistics are kind of arcane and varied, I want to kind of draw them out to show you the point. So the other point about holding the middle, I think, is being realistic. We have massive challenges, and the core challenge, and that's my issue, is economic growth. We need economic growth. So if you go to the next slide, again, this is data you will have seen, but kind of I pulled it out. One of the issues is we've lost 15 years of growth. That's the truth. So if you simply mathematically go back and assume we grew 3% for the last 15 years, not what we actually did do, you get that left-hand chart. You can see how much bigger the economy is versus where it is. It's about, I can't see it, it's about 30% or thereabouts. That's a 3% growth. Had we run at 5%, we'd be dramatically different. Now, if our country was 25 or 30% bigger, its economy, we'd be in a different place. We'd be a middle to upper income country. We'd be completely different in just 15 years. We've squandered that time, and that's a terrible thing. Second from the right, looking at house prices in Cape Town, in the Western Cape versus Gauteng in Joburg, unacceptable municipal services and management and corruption. You can see it in Johannesburg. The red line is inflation. The blue line on the higher level, so I'm second from the right. I hope I'm not boring you guys with this data. But second from the right, you can see the Cape, I think it's the Western Cape or Cape Town, doesn't matter, actually is inflated above inflation. So people's core assets here are appreciating better than inflation. In Johannesburg, we've flatlined. It's a tragedy. We know that for most people, their homes are their biggest asset. That's what they have. So you can talk about services and all the emotions around it. The fact is the core assets of people are stagnating and in real terms declining. That's just not acceptable. And then finally, on employment, you can see on the right-hand side, that's an old story. It's the biggest tragedy we have. Millions of people unemployed, and that continues to go up. So I guess the first kind of axiom or hypothesis I want to put to you is that building the country is about holding the middle, and holding the middle, first and foremost, in my view, is about creating a realistic sense of loss aversion, understanding the potential, not writing us off, not treating us with disrespect. This is a big country of considerable potential, but being realistic about where our problems are. And I believe our problems are fundamentally economic growth. That's at the core of our problem. Gets to the second point, and if you can go to the slide. As part of this process, and Alec, you know, well, we've spoken about this many, many times, but business, together with government, formed a partnership. In a sense, early on, quite controversial around working with government towards creating economic growth. I think it was an amazing, and remains an amazing, amazing initiative, right? So I'm just waiting for that slide. There we go. Sorry, one back. The start of this partnership was exactly what I'm telling you here. It was based on hope and potential, not on data. We got virtually every large CEO to sign a pledge that they believe in the potential of the country. I was principal and part of a team that actually spoke to CEOs. It took literally 20 minutes to get that done. You can't believe the goodwill there is about potential. People are cross about what's happened and this, that, and the other. And in every annual report and every release, you hear all this stuff. But at the core, do people, do business leaders believe in the potential of the country? It's unequivocal. So getting that pledge signed, I was going to put it up for you, but you can read it. It's just a simple pledge. We believe in the potential of the country and committed to building it. So from this kind of fluffy, emotional pledge, we built a very careful structure with government. Three focal areas: energy, transport and logistics, crime and corruption, and the belief, the research we did showed that those three things are the fulcrum for growth. Get those right, and bear in mind this is at the heart of load shedding. Get that right, and the economy will start to grow. And then we, in phase two, created this kind of virtuous cycle. Get growth, get jobs, and change the narrative. And it's circular because growth is causal. It creates jobs. Jobs and growth creates a better narrative, and narrative creates growth. I want to talk on that in a moment because that's the third issue. And that's really what we did. It's an amazing structure. The structure is well governed. We've actually spoken about it globally as a model for any developing country. Every developing country has an asymmetry of risks, of skills between public and private. How can they work together? It's well governed. We don't fund government. We fund the facilitation of the partnership. We don't develop policy. We're a business community. We help execute. So we've created a very careful rubric for this. We have a lot of heat from a lot of people saying, why are you doing this? You're propping up government. Let them do this, et cetera, et cetera. Our view is we don't have time to kind of debate this stuff. We've got to build. We've got to get load shedding down. We've got to get the economy going. We've got to kind of turn this flywheel to get economic growth. To the next slide. I mean, has it worked? I think we're remarkably proud of the process. There's been excellent work in Eskom. I don't think we should take credit for all, but you know, the load shedding came down. It's an incredible thing. This thing was just going worse and worse. Sorry, going up is getting worse. As you can see, load shedding timed. In 9 months, we turned that thing around. Now, there were a lot of coincidental things at the same time, but I can tell you, 57 companies gave 9,000 hours of work on the energy side of this partnership. It's amazing what was done. We spent, I think, $700 million on the logistics grid, on the freight rail grid in the process. The scale of it is tremendous. Load shedding is down. I think structural load shedding is gone. There'll be bumps in the road. We've seen it, but I think those days of what we've seen is gone. We have to just keep pushing. On the issue of jobs, can we create them? We know it. 3% growth, the country creates jobs. The coefficients, the data shows it. Our projections show if we can get that growth to 3%, and we're not. We can get that growth to 3%. We can grow 350,000 jobs a year. 1 million households affected. By 2029, that's 10 million people. We can lift people out of poverty. That's what we have to do. So we created this kind of mantra: growth, jobs, narrative, right? And we set out this issue, we need to get to 3% growth. I'm actually proud of that framing because that actually features in a lot of the narrative now. I think if you read the budget, Alec, I think some of the budget discussion is below 3%, we've got a problem. At 1% growth, we're losing jobs, right? Understand it. For companies to just stay where they are, we're losing jobs. At 3%, you're creating jobs. At 5%, it's remarkable. the country creates jobs. So we've broken that like hoodoo of the link between growth. Whenever people say, well, growth doesn't lead to jobs, it does. We've got to get growth. So the second issue I'm saying to you, beside the loss aversion, is an activist constructive engagement with all parties to build a country. I think that is the second piece. The third piece is narrative, sentiment. Now, a lot has been said about this. I've been about this for many, many years. If I go to the next slide, it's a very, very important point. Narrative, how people feel, what they speak about, is so fundamental to our progress in realizing our potential. I'm sorry, these are very dry slides, but on the left-hand side, and the papers, can we circulate these slides, Alec? We can, if you be. On the left-hand side is a fascinating paper that looks at how narrative affects developed countries versus developing countries. If you have a very positive narrative in America or the UK or whatever, it does have an effect, but it wears off quite quickly. The reason is because people know asset prices in America. You're with me? They understand the economy. Investors know it. Societies know it. But in developing markets, you find that narrative lasts much longer. If people talk better about South Africa and global markets, no one knows what's going on here. BlackRock sitting in New York has no idea in detail what's going on here. If they hear about the Expropriation Act, they get scared. If they hear about good things, they invest. There's no rational knowledge amongst the world about us. I've seen that. So when I go to Davos and I had a chance meeting with the top asset manager, and he says to me, I hear things are going well down in South Africa. That is like gold to us. That narrative is causal, and it creates a massive amount of investment. So in a developing market, especially one like ours, narrative is causal. It's not a nice to have. It's fundamental. If we can drive out the narrative, we can create growth. And then on the right-hand side, something that troubles me, and I wanted to put it to you. And again, I think that the slide doesn't bring this to life, but I urge you to look at Ron Engelhardt's work. He's one of the really doyens about values, and he's behind the World Survey of Values. It turns out that the research shows that in a society, values change. They flip between survivalist values and free expression values. And essentially, when people are concerned about things and they frail, they think the future's at risk, they become survival-focused. They become inward-looking. They stick to clans. They become very focused on themselves. They become inflexible, and they become undemocratic. When you go to the right-hand side, where people are feeling secure, there's potential, you get this free expression, the self-expression of values. People communicate. They coordinate. They express themselves. And critically, they vote. They participate in democracy. So if you want to see change, whether it's for this government, against, wherever you may sit, I'm making the point, you get a better chance of a rational election when you have self-expression, when people feel secure. So getting back to that earlier idea of the government partnership, our view was letting an Eskom fail or letting the grid fail would create a survivalist mindset. That would not lead to a good outcome in elections. If you think it would, it wouldn't. You get a centrist approach, you get a holding of the middle when people feel secure. And the data shows that. So bring it all together. My hypothesis to you is that we should be holding the middle. We shouldn't let the extremes get out. I think holding the middle is about one thing. Jobs, growth, jobs, narrative. We should do nothing that unwinds that. We should pass no laws that undermine growth, jobs, narrative. That's what we should do. So, you know, when it comes to foreign policy, policy shifts, my view is we've got millions of people in poverty. What we need is growth. That's what we should focus on. The potential is there. Hold the middle and focus on growth, jobs, and narrative. The final point I wanted to make, there's a lot of laws that people are very, very concerned about. I do want to touch on NHI. I've got 2 minutes, Alec, above hand. You'd ask me to just say one or two things on NHI. NHI is one of those laws that kills sentiment. It's a problematic law, not in concept and directionally. Having an NHI, having universal healthcare, we have to fix a healthcare system. That's a critical thing. So we are, seen as Discovery, as the private healthcare system, absolutely committed to helping make NHI workable. But our position has been, it cannot work without private sector collaboration. You cannot kill the private sector. It is fraught with difficulty. We have an incredible private healthcare system that's egalitarian, it's big, it's of considerable quality. We need to grow it. It's a powerful asset. And so the pinch point of this particular law has been this idea that once it is fully implemented, medical schemes can't exist. You're really killing off the private healthcare system. You know this well. But to give you some comfort, like most of these laws, we are constructively working with government. To everyone's credit, no one believes this is imminent. The regulations were passed last week. This is intergenerational. This is a long, long process. And I think you will see a natural collaboration between the two. Just some numbers to give you a sense of the challenge here. And that's why it's important to understand. If I can take you through this, there's a lot of thought about $200 billion being needed for NHI. Just on the right hand side, you can see what medical scheme members or people that employed are spending about 2,300 rand a month on healthcare. That's what they're spending on average. People in the public sector, I can't see the numbers directly, but it's about 450 rand. You can see the inequality. But now if you have an NHI that is one size fits all, you put a 200 billion into it, into one big fund. Unfortunately, all you buy is 700 rand of care for everyone. So the public sector people go up from 450 to 700. That's good, but it's not enough to do anything. And the employed sector go down from 2,300 to 700. That's a 69 or 70% drop. I forget the numbers, but thereabouts. But then you add, where do you get the 200 billion from if you were to do it today? Well, you need to raise VAT by 6.5%. Now, we put these slides together long before this current budget debate. You can see we're raising it 0.5% is just to pay general expenses. You simply can't do this. We don't have the fiscal room to do it. This is not a gloating. This is a tragedy. We don't have that money as a country. If you think we can grow into it, on the right-hand side, just shows a few data points that you'll need about 8% growth for 20 years to free up that amount of money. So just to make the point to you, these acts are very, this piece of law, as the others are, very threatening and very worrying in many ways. Directionally, they're right. We have to fix the healthcare system. We should be supportive of it. But we shouldn't overstate the concerns of it. So in NHI, we will continue to engage. We put across a variety. You mentioned NHI and sirens go off, and I don't know, that's heavy to come and get me. I don't know what I'm saying, but on the stuff, I hope I don't sound sanguine or naive. This is a complicated issue, but the cause is a good one. Directionally, we support it. It needs collaboration. But when you look at the actual numbers, it's not doable in the short term. This is a decade, two-decade intergenerational process, and so we should be rational about it. So let me end where I started. I believe the country has considerable potential. My basic hypothesis and plea is leadership that holds the middle. You can feel when one extreme comes out, the other side comes out as well, and you quickly destroy people's mindset. You change values. You get a survivalist mindset, and that leads to bad outcomes, especially in places in the world that are complicated with massive inequality. We've got to be very careful. My plea is for a different approach to leadership and an engagement that is constructive. We can build up. I think we are. And that's it, Ellie. That's what I wanted to say. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Adrian. It's been an interesting a theme that seems to be coming through more and more. From day one, we need the government of national unity. What Gayton was saying this morning was the alternative. What Helen Ziller said, the alternative is too ghastly to contemplate. What he was saying this morning was similar. Just on NHI, before we go to questions, because there's a lot of people who've got questions for you. If the MK were the party running the country, and if they were to come to power in 2029, how different would the engagement be? And really what I'm trying to get to here is the assumption is MK would come in and this is our way or the highway. How much engagement have you had on NHI with the Government of National Unity?
There's been a lot of engagement. There's been, can you hear me? I hope you can. There's been formal meetings that I think you know where business, organized business, BUSA presented a number of alternatives. And that's been a pretty rational process. The noise and narrative coming out is often much more extreme and destructive on it. But directionally, I still feel confident about finding a middle line. About a month ago, you remember there was a potential deal around the private sector. But the issue here is when you look at the numbers, especially the NHI, It's not a piece of oil you can switch on. You need the funding, you know. So to an extent, unless you are intent on destroying the country, you cannot implement it. You know, you could say tomorrow we killing off the private healthcare system, you destroy every business. I think, you know, this is much bigger than private healthcare. This is about the economy. So I think that there's a rational engagement. I do think that in the people that really are in the know, even in the Department of Health, which is feels very strongly about this, there's an acceptance that this is a long-term process. And I think in the minister's affidavit in one of the court cases has made the point that this is a 10, 15-year process. So my sense is that in the case of NHI, the kind of reality about the funding overrides ideology on whatever side you're on of this issue, and we have to find a rational way. The only scenario I can see of like a blunt NHI that's destructive is someone who's moving to destroy the country. You know, and then I think this is a sovereign issue. This is not about healthcare. This is a much bigger issue. And even then, you don't have money. You don't have the cash for it. So that's the point. You know? I mean, what's lost in this, I just want to say, is just people don't understand the quality of that system. Forget about us as a fund. I'm saying the quality of hospitals and doctors and access. And go to the UK and try the NHS and see what it's like. Yeah. And just, again, loss aversion. Understand what we have to lose, you know.
Yeah, well, the medical tourism is certainly pretty reaffirming that whole issue. How important is the government of national unity from where you're sitting?
I think it's very important. Ironically, I think losing it is more scarier than getting it. It's more scary than the goodness of getting it. I think losing it, the symbolism of losing it, is not good. But if it wasn't here in the first place, I think that we'd muddle on, because there's some resilience, you know, and hopefully that, you know, as a private sector we can do a lot. But I think it's very important. And I think, as you're saying, the minister previously and other speakers, the alternatives are problematic. And that's why I worry about the extremes. You know, if you're in a rational environment with many actors with different policies and different ideas, and I want to try stuff, and you relying on an election that brings out rational stuff, but you're not. I think in most societies, when they're really under threat, as you can see from the data, you get that survivalist mindset and you lose the center. And the one thing about the previous election, the GNU, 75% of the electorate voted in the center, you know, didn't vote for the extremes. That's a massive asset. We should never forget that. So I'm ignoring policies and the detail about the GNU. I think the GNU represents the middle I'm speaking about. So if you believe in holding the middle, you've got to hold that GNU. I think every time we hear about a debate in government that it's going to fall apart, I know they have to flex their muscles all over. It's a great thing. It could be a fantastic illustration of how GNU should work, this VAT issue. But I don't think we should see ultimatums, you know, as South Africans all the time. Will it, won't it, will it? I hope it holds. We need it. The alternative is worse.
Adrian, let's just say that the DA plays absolute hardball, says, nah, we're not going with this 0.5%, walks out of the GNU, as Gate McKenzie said, has been threatened. If you recall, as you well do, in 2015 December, you might have even been in the room when business went to Zuma and said, look, we don't care what you're doing, but your takeover of the Treasury with the weekend special, Des van Rooyen, is not going to fly. And you actually got Zuma to change their mind and bring in Pravin Gordhan that Sunday night. Would it be a similar crisis from what you've just said, that loss aversion of the GNU? Would you maybe get hold of Helen and say, whoa, you got to stay in?
Look, I mean, I can't talk for business formally in that context, but my sense is that it's interesting. Business is the most trusted social partner, and unlike most countries, business has the highest trust amongst South Africans, which is quite unique, especially given how South Africa is constituted. So I think business's view is an important one, and government does not listen, you know, but takes it into account. I think that there would be those kind of discussions, but I think the Zuma 2015 issue was around state capture. It was a capturing of treasury. It wasn't a policy debate, so to speak. You know what I'm saying? I think that a policy debate is a democratic process, whereas I think state capture is a concern that treasury is being taken. But we should generally, maybe that's my point, not, we should be calling for the middle all the time. We shouldn't allow these things to fracture.
But the debate on state capture was with the capturer in chief. This time around, it's with someone that business funds, i.e. the DA without business's funding would not have much chance in the next election.
Look, that's beyond my, I mean, I think funding and demanding are two different things. I think you fund something in good faith and you hope that that party fulfills a set of policies. I don't think you use the funding as a lever, so to speak, but that process in 2015 was not as simple as it sounded. It was pretty brutal and it's quite scary. I hope we pass those years.
Indeed, we all do. Martin asks, in the context of expropriation without compensation, how sure can we be that the medical aid reserves will be safe? So leave NHI for the moment. If government is looking for money.
I don't have. I mean, I think that the Expropriation Act is worrying because every country, every government has a right to expropriate land, but not without compensation. I mean, that's the piece. There are protections in it, and we'll see how that plays out. And this is not ideal stuff, as we know. But does it extend to medical scheme reserves? I've never thought of that. I can't see, you know, I think you're in a downward spiral when you get to that level, you know. So I think that our medical scheme reserves are safe. Don't be concerned. I wouldn't be.
I've been hearing more alarms and sirens in the last couple of days in Hermanus than ever before. So there must be a lot of important people in town. please tell us, Jan van der Westhuizen wants to know more about Discovery Energy and the offtake agreements and arrangements with Eskom. We had Dan Morricani here yesterday, and he left me feeling a lot more confident. I hope everybody as well. And in September, Mteto Nyati was here, who had the same impact or the same effect. What you've said now about businesses' involvement with Eskom and working together to overcome this load shedding issue, this whole Discovery Energy, did it come out of that conversation?
No, not at all. First, this important issue of governance. Businesses working with government, and we made it clear in the structure, there's a collective. There's no individual businesses that can reach out and discuss issues in those. That's not on the table. We're there to fulfill a structure. We have a kind of an energy CEO in each stream, a CEO in each of the streams. So it's completely independent. We were actually looking at how to extend vitality, this is over a number of years, into how people behave from a climate perspective. Could we incentivize them to do healthy things by way of the climate and incentivize them? And we started to look at kind of food and all the different issues, complicated stuff, but found the real issue was energy. If you can get people to use renewable energy, it would be a good thing. So a number of years ago, we started to think about, could we actually facilitate renewable energy? And we've started to build this trading platform and working with our clients who are all looking for energy solutions and want to be able to deal with their kind of different processes of climate. That's where it came out of. I think it's incredibly exciting. And again, there's friction in the system. Now, we had some litigation around getting the license and, you know, all kinds of stuff. These are the kind of regulatory wasteful things, in my view, that cost the country growth. But I think directionally, with the ERA and the process going forward in energy, us and many others will actually be able to invest. I mean, there's billions, as you know, hundreds of billions sitting waiting to invest. And I think that is that's a sector that, if done well, creates jobs. You're going to lay these solar panels. I mean, a gigawatt of solar panels is like halfway to Cape Town, I think. You know, I don't think people realize the scale. You know, I think that the renewable industry could be a kind of a Marshall Plan for employment growth. You know, we need to use it in some of that scale. But for us, it's a business one of our team is building. It has no relationship to that. It's interesting. And I've had the same discussions with Dan. I mean, he's pretty sanguine and I think quite encouraging. Let's see how it plays out.
There are 20 under 25s who have been sponsored by members of the business community here. A lot of them are potential entrepreneurs. I'm sure they're sitting here waiting to hear your advice. What do you, and it's a passion of yours. What do you say to young people today who are in South Africa who are thinking of making their mark in entrepreneurship?
Well, the one thing that I would say, and it's kind of mathematically clear, when times are difficult, people perceive that to be difficult, prices are depressed. There are more opportunities. So my sense is that the best time to build is when people are concerned. You know, it sounds counterintuitive. Discovery started in 1992, 93. It's actually the literary anniversary a few days back. And we started right at the change from apartheid to democracy, Bichu massacre, remember Boy Patong. I mean, most of my colleagues were emigrating. We're like, what are you doing? Are you an idiot starting a business here? Well, many of them are now working for us, right? And that's the point, because I think that in difficult times, when people are distracted, opportunities are much bigger. And that's one thing I'd say. The other is, I think great businesses have a clear purpose. And I think if you're just setting out now as an entrepreneur to just make a quick buck, I mean, I'm not saying you won't do it. I don't think that that's a sustainable issue. So my view is we're in a country with massive challenge, social challenge, all kinds of things. You see, these industries are big, you know, whether it's energy, health, whatever it is. It's a great place for small entrepreneurs. And the one thing I'll tell you, Eric, which is interesting, I mean, I often go to these entrepreneurial get-togethers, Ernst & Young or whatever. Entrepreneurs are optimistic, you know what I mean? They don't care about like macroeconomic growth and the VAT rate and whatever. I've been corrupted, as you can see, as an entrepreneur, right? But truthfully, they are, how do I get ahead? How do I build something? How do I make a mark? And that energy is kind of contagious. So my view, is don't be deterred by the complexity. This is your time. That's one. The other is purpose, and the other is optimism. And, you know, just keep that passion alive. I mean, it's an amazing world out there to build.
Discovery is a 137 billion rand market cap company. How many people have you got?
Employees, 15,000.
15,000. How do you keep entrepreneurship going and not getting swamped by bureaucracy?
Firstly, I don't think that's – I think in some cases we fight that battle all the time. I mean, my approach is purpose-based. You mentioned our business model, which keeps opening up new adjacencies. So we are continuously in the build phase. We built our bank. You know, it's taken us 10 years. It's quite amazing. A business of that scale takes a long time to build. But we're always in the J curve of building, and that keeps you humble. It keeps you excited. I don't think Discovery is the type to sit in the boardroom, you know, pondering the world and drinking cognac. I mean, we're not those kind of guys, you know. And we are, and in truth, I know we're a 7-8 billion market cap today in dollars. By global standards, that's small. I'm feeling pretty frustrated. Need to build a lot more. So I'm not. I'm not feeling things are going well. We can take it easy. I'm like, I've got limited time. I've got to make a massive, massive impact.
What do you mean by that? Limited time?
Time. You need a decade, you know. We've got to push. Our team knows this is a critical time of growing. We've really got something that is so globally relevant, you know. So we've got a session tomorrow here in Cape Town with some of our key people, some of our non-execs around really how do we scale what we've done. We've now built the business into two distinct pieces. The bank is really scaling here at a rapid rate. And our global stuff is getting very good traction. How do we get that to the next level? It requires a mindset of just discipline and focus and huge work. You know, it's a very exciting phase.
What about people and the Nebel Kupovitz and Ethos Rushevitz both came to our conference in May. And I could see their smiles on their faces on what's going on in the UK with Discovery and the Vitality operation. But you would think that such high quality people to go and conquer that market might take away from, say, what you're doing here. How do you make those calls on who to send where?
People have like naturally moved into different places. We've now got a very clear structure of two, you know, South African business and a global business with clear CEOs and a very strong executive structure. But one thing about Discovery is we've hired the best people. We've got 1,000 people, and I mean that. You know, we've got 1,000 PhDs that can do the work. There's no scarcity. We have been meticulous about choosing the best actuarial talent, technology, medical. There's no shortage. So if you look at our processes here, and this is not hubris, it's a deliberate strategy. There's no shortage of quality people. But the truth is, in the tail, there are few people that can build. You know, they can put down roots and build. And those people, you've got to be very careful about how you play. But we've got a very, very deep bench. No concern.
In the internet boom, I recall that businesses were all putting .com after their name. Now they're all trying to tell you how good they are at AI. Having spoken with Hilton Kellner, your colleague, years ago he was telling me about the AI that you were putting in there. Are you not missing a trick at Discovery and explaining to potential investors and maybe those who would improve your rating that you're also a deep AI shop?
You know, we now are launching Vitality AI, right? Because it actually is using a lot of machine learning to determine exactly what you should do. So maybe we get a bit of that. But I'm jaundiced about these fads that you're kind of trying to get a valuation on. I mean, at the end of the day, if it doesn't lead to scale of proper real earnings, it's not sustainable. So I think we truthfully are in a very, very leadership role in using data and technology. You'll see in the bank, we're rolling out something quite amazing in the next couple of weeks that's using AI and data and fantastic for customers. But I would prefer you see the manifestation of the stuff rather than just the labeling of it. But Vitality is moving into a completely hyper-personalized place where we'll be able to tell you what you should do, what that next best action is for you that will have the best effect on your health based on your risk factors. And that's a complicated AI problem.
I remember in Davos, you get into all the best places usually, but this time, because of our partnership with the FT, I got into to see someone who you would have liked to have seen as well, the Nobel Prize winner on AI, who's running all of Google's artificial intelligence. And it was interesting, he was saying in that little group that one of the biggest applications is health, that artificial intelligence may be bringing cures to lots of health issues much, much quicker. Have you been able to, or clearly you'll be following this, have you been able to see any concrete proof of it yet?
Yes and no. I think that drug discovery, for example, these drug trials and how people here will know that stuff takes so long and costs so much and takes decades of time. I think AI in those kind of areas will have a massive effect. Where we are, the ability to actually work out precision personalized healthcare has a massive effect. So we're on that trail, and I think the potential is incredible. The problem with healthcare is, and I need to make that point, is that technology drives costs up. In every industry, technology brings prices down. It's called the Baumol effect. In healthcare, we can, Keytruda for cancer, all the different, this stuff is layered on and brings prices up and drives inflation. And that's why you get the CPI plus 3% continued inflation. That's one of the reasons. But it's a wonderful thing. You can do more and more with it. And I think I'm absolutely where AI is. It could change things dramatically. I think technology for the first time has the potential to drop prices while increasing access.
Kai Miller asks, Discovery's incentive-based approach has successfully improved individual health and financial decisions. In your view, how could we translate these same behavioral economics principles into a public sector context where performance metrics and accountability are often less direct?
You definitely could. You definitely could. I mean, it's being done. I'm not sure if you're talking about the public sector incentivizing people. It's done in markets like Singapore. They have a Vitality-like program. Our team has worked with them. In Brazil, you have this conditional payments where certain social grants are conditional on certain behaviors. So there's no reason not to do it. But there's always a complex policy issue of using the tax base to incentivize people. If you're dealing with actual public sector performance, I mean, that's just more remuneration strategy and bonuses and measuring performance, which, as you know, is a complex political issue. But intellectually and in terms of behavioral science, there's no doubt you can do that.
Andrew Van Damme wants to know, what effect has COVID had on the mortality curve, if any?
There's long COVID, as you know well, and we've seen that it's not dramatically affecting mortality. Our mortality rates are down. So at the moment, we're seeing much lower mortality than we expected. And in fact, lower than we expect in our vitality statuses, because per status, we expect a reduction. And in fact, people are outperforming that. So mortality is much lower. The COVID effect is not anecdotal. I mean, you're seeing it in cases, the long COVID, but we're not seeing enough of it to drive mortality, quite the opposite.
Ryan Shane asks, Adrian, there have been foreign outflows on the JSE of around 60 billion year to date, accelerating from last year. What do you think it takes to reverse this trend?
I think it takes what I was talking about. I think if people see a country that has potential, is positive, and is growing, you will see inflows into the market. It's as simple as that. I think the issues of governance, I mean, to be fair, the LSE, as you would know, the London Stock Exchange, is dead as well. You know, too much governance, too much red tape. It's just really killed off animal spirits, and you're not seeing those. You're not seeing massive IPOs. You're not seeing a discovery list at the moment. I'm not seeing it. It's tragic. So I think there's a combination of growth sentiment, but I think that public companies need some kind of a release on some of the regulation. We need the animal spirits back. We need to see more IPOs. The private markets are getting so big, as you know, and that's a problem.
So would you then be a supporter of what's happening in the US right now with the resuscitation of animal spirits?
A qualified yes. I think that the regulation has created a industry of just continual regulation that I think in some cases is needed, but in others it isn't. And I think that there is too much regulation. I think there's, you know, independence of audit committees, and, you know, I think that's excellent. But some of the kind of the consumer regulations, the things that slow innovation down, I think are too much. So it's a qualified yes. I'm concerned about just absolute, you know, potential market abuse, but I think it has cost too much, and therefore I think that focus on deregulation, uncluttering things, giving companies the ability to grow unfettered, you need that. You need that for growth. And you need failure for growth. This allergy to companies failing is anathema to how markets work. Companies will fail and shareholders will lose money. That's the deal, you know.
I warned you that there are people here who aren't fans of yours. One of them asks, Discovery basically forced their staff to take the COVID vaccine and strongly pushed its use. Has there been a backlash from COVID vaccine injuries?
We haven't seen that at all. So unequivocally, we did force our staff. So we had a vaccine mandate. I know that has all kinds of ideological kind of views on it. And in fact, our approach of incentivizing health is the opposite of regulating, you know, a mandate's a regulatory issue. But with a massive head office of people crowded together, with the data we saw, we took that view. And I can tell you, and we have the data, we have tracked millions of people. There are certainly cases where the vaccine may have done something to people, but drowned out by the number of people say about the vaccine. So happy to share that data with anyone of how that worked. It was an amazing issue. We all learned some lessons in COVID, you know, locking people down, et cetera, et cetera. We'll come out of this stronger, I think. Hopefully we never see it again in our lifetime. It was an absolute terrible thing.
Adrian, why do you think, and I know you do follow all of these issues, why do you think that there's so much skepticism about the data? We had many conversations during COVID. I spoke to your chief actuary numerous times. Every time that we put out the data that you had, there was an assumption from a certain group in our community to say, oh no, they're lying, they're not telling the truth. Why? Maybe just real rational data actuary mind looking at it, what would the incentive be to lie, and what would be the incentive be to say the truth?
As the accused, I can only tell you it's not true. I have no idea. I think the vaccination issue is an ideological issue. It's beyond that, and on both sides of this, we kind of lost the truth and lost the science in it. And therefore, no matter what you do, you can't quell the other side. All I can say to you is we'd be happy to put data for you in a room with an auditor to check it out and be happy you're comfortable with it. I can show you our mortality data. I just don't think you will quell certain segment of people's views with their deep-held views that vaccination is a bad thing and it must have killed people. And I've had a lot of stuff on our, it's actually come off now. But saying it's not true, they've seen the data, it's bizarre to me. Our entire business is based on data. And there's nothing in it for us to be untruthful. I mean, quite the opposite. I mean, we could show people were dying at a rapid rate. We could change rates. There's no reason to illustrate health rather than... So it's not clear to me, but I give you the absolute comfort The data is there anytime you want to see it, analyze it. And in my experience, 99% of people we deal with are happy with that. In fact, quite comforted by it. But there is that fringe that feels differently. It is what it is.
Talking about the fringe, have you met Elon Musk?
No, I haven't. I haven't. I haven't.
What do you think of what he's doing in America?
I think his entrepreneurial achievements are quite remarkable. I think he's a genius. I think he's changed the world, and I think we should respect that. I think he's given South African entrepreneurs some kind of sex appeal. Now, maybe that will change soon. But I'm concerned about the process at the moment. I'm concerned, forget about Elon Musk, about an elected. That process is troubling. If it leads to efficiency, and let's see how it plays out, but I think there'll be a backlash. So I'm not sure how it plays out. It's too early to call. Let's see what happens with him. I'm just scared structurally of such rapid change, unelected, what it does. But is he a genius? Is he directionally trying to do the right thing of cutting down bureaucracy and waste? But breaking things down is easier than building them. You know, when you break something down without plan, I'm not sure where it gets to. So it's again above my ability to judge, but I'm respectful but concerned.
Adrian Gore, thank you for coming to us.
Now you can get the cheapest Forex rate around, right here, on Shift. Pay less for your dollars, pounds, and euros here, and get to shop more here, and do more here, and enjoy more ooh-la-la here. Shift also lets you trade and transfer currencies, and buy shares in the world's best companies. It all happens right here, on Shift. You won't find a cheaper Forex rate anywhere else, no matter where you bank. Download the Shift app today.
In the world of business banking, projections, numbers, and your bottom line can often triumph over relationships. At Investec, we value both. That's why we understand that running a successful business takes endurance, drive, and partners who are willing to walk the journey with you. Make the move from business as usual to Investec Business Banking. Out of the ordinary.
Downings is South Africa's leading marquee infrastructure company, proudly celebrating 25 years of excellence. Renowned for creativity, innovation, and unmatched technical expertise, our event marquees and semi-permanent structures elevate any project with style and sophistication. Whether it's a corporate event or a commercial project, we tailor every structure to meet your needs with world-class precision. Visit downings.co.za to consult with our expert team. Downings, your trusted marquee specialists nationwide.